morning, everyone. We're going to try to get started. We've got a lot of stuff that's on the agenda today. I want to go through the agenda and explain a few things as to what we are able to do today versus what we aren't for multiple reasons. All right, we have, based on my count, six bills that are here for possible for public hearing and possible work session. We have 14 work session bills. And speaking with staff who was here late in the hours last night and early in the morning to get everything together, this is what I understand and what our status is. We're waiting for multiple things to come back, including either amendments, fiscal or revenue statements, so there are certain things that aren't able to be moved or worked today. All right, so I am going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 186, and the purpose for that is I'm going to be carrying that bill over until Monday, April 18th. I'll close the work session, open a work session on Senate Bill 408, same thing, that will be carried over until Monday, April 18th, close the work session, open a work session on Senate Bill 616, that one is going to also be carried over until Monday, April 18th, close the work session on it. Open the work session on 619, and we're opening that for the same reason. We'll be carrying that one over until Monday, April 18th. Close the work session on it, and I am going to open up a work session on 740, and we are also carrying that bill over until Monday, April 18th. Again, those, and I'll close the work session on that one. Those are being carried over for the reasons that we do not have the amendments at this point, and so we cannot work the bills at this point. Regarding, there are three bills that deal with firearms, Senate Bill 582 and 934. The chair is going to be carrying over 934. 934 will be the vehicle. 762 and 582 will not be going forward after today, but the concept in 582 will in fact be going into 934. So that's a point of reference for those who are here on those matters. All right, now we have five bills that are scheduled for public hearing. Just to let you know where they're at, Senate Bill 378, 496, 874, 926, and 934. They're in a position where we can do the public hearings on those, and so I will go through those in that order. We have whatever we can't complete on those, and in my understanding, I believe those are actually will have to be carried over for work session because we don't have all of the paperwork that's necessary, but we should be able to do the public hearings on those. We have, at this point, the following bills that are ready to work on the work session's agenda. Senate Bill 557-2, 815, 867-2, and 878. And at that, we'll work those because we have everything we need. And then we have on the remaining work session bills, 346 with a dash 1 and a dash 2, 450 with a dash 2, 734 with a dash 1, and 783 with a dash 2 and a dash 3. Those are possible work, will be worked today. We're waiting to see if fiscal and revenue statements are able to come in. So we will not even get to those until the end of our day to determine whether or not we have the paperwork to work them. If we don't, those will be carried over until Monday as well, if I'm not mistaken. Okay. So, with the game plan like that, I know that I have two members here. I have Representative Thatcher and Senator Telfer. I don't know if she's actually in the room now or not. Kim, did you want to go ahead and give testimony on 934? I can open a public hearing for you to do that, and then we can, so you can get back to do the work you need to do. All right. I'm going to go ahead and open a public hearing on 934, Senate Bill 934. Cheyenne, you can give us the opening on that.
Hold your patience for just a moment, Mr. Chair, members. Senate Bill 934. Council then summarized the preliminary SMSs in its draft form and indicates that an amendment is impending as a replacement measure.
All right. Representative Thatcher, when you're ready.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Kim Thatcher, representative from Kaiser, Newburgh, and St. Paul, and appreciate you hearing this. I think it's a good bill. There's a few reasons for it. I think, one, it saves the state money, and it helps gun owners who are now waiting for up to a month to make a purchase, and it helps small businesses trying to make it in a tough economy. About it saving money, right now OSP or state police spends about $7 to $8 million a biennium processing background checks for gun purchases, and about half that money comes from the fee charged to the purchaser. The other half has been a mixture of general fund and other funds in recent years, and OSP is now proposing to nearly triple that fee on gun purchases to cover the other half of the funding they need to keep the program going. By turning these gun background checks over to the federal government, we eliminate the need for most of these checks to be done at the state level and eliminate the need for the fee increase, which would take the pressure off the agency to find a way to cover up to $4 million in administrative costs every biennium. A second, it helps gun purchasers. We've had multiple complaints from Oregonians trying to buy firearms from gun dealers who are told that it might take over a month for OSP to process their background check. And often, these are folks who have been buying guns for years and without any problem up until semi-recently, trying to get these checks through. The FBI runs the National Instant Check System, or NICS. They have a good, very, very good track record. In fact, 92% of the background checks were completed while the dealer was still on the phone with the NICS, and the federal system does not charge a fee to the gun purchaser. There's no fee to the gun purchaser like there is now to the OSP. And I should add, many people view this fee as a tax on their Second Amendment rights. But third, this helps small businesses because many of the gun stores in Oregon are small mom-and-pop stores, which maybe have one or two employees. And when a customer is told they have to wait a month to get their background check completed, people will often leave without making a purchase. The employees at the gun store have to spend hours on hold with the OSP just to get through to submit the information required for the background check, which isn't good for business either. A couple other points to keep in mind is that the private party transactions like the ones at gun shows would still be conducted with OSP. This legislation is only to covering the federally licensed dealers, such as what 35 other states use exclusively. And there have been few complaints from gun dealers or problems with criminals getting guns that they shouldn't have. And the federal check is a complete background check for criminal and mental health problems. And according to the National Shooting Sports Foundation, which represents gun dealers across the country, they've said Oregon law does not require a more extensive background check than the already comprehensive check that is done by the or performed by the FBI. We have reviewed the comparison list of what OSP does for their background checks and what the feds do, and have not been able to find any significant pertinent differences. And under state and federal law, a gun can be sold within 3 days without a background check. So if we're going to do these background checks, it would be better to do them sooner rather than later, and the federal government does them sooner in this case. Thank you for your consideration.
All right, thank you. Any questions for the representative?
Just briefly, thank you, Mr. Chair. Kim, I've got an email here from a constituent in Medford who's runs an auction, and this individual had alerted the OSP on Tuesday before the Saturday auction, and then again on Friday before the Saturday auction that they were going to have an auction. And the OSP was unable to answer the phone for 3.5 hours during the auction, so they couldn't really get any background. Is that something that is systemic in the system? I mean, have you heard that before, or that not only is it a cost factor, but there's simply a lack of service?
Right. People are having to hold for hours trying to get through, and then many times they're being told it's going to take up to a month to get that background check, and so then they lose customers.
Thank you.
All right, any other questions for Representative Thatcher? Kim, thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you very much.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to recess 9:34. We're going to go back up into the order. So I'll recess 9:34. We'll come back to that as I stated. One other piece of information that has come to my attention, I announced that we would be doing a public hearing on Senate Bill 926. I've been given a note that the parties who are working on that bill are not ready to go forward. The amendment is not there, and they're not ready to, let's say, discuss it without having final agreements, etc. So Senate Bill 926 is also going to be carried over with the other bills I've mentioned to Monday, for Monday, April 18th. Now, I understand, speaking with one of the individuals that are working on 926, they may not have the amendments set until sometime toward the end of the middle of the week. I'm leaving it on for the 18th to make certain we don't lose it. And if it is ready, then we will go forward. If not, we'll see where we're at. But realize, for everyone, that anything we still have, we have to get it out by the end of a week from today, the 21st. That's why I wanted to systematically keep them there. If we can move them, we're going to move them. If we can't, then we'll, you know, just wait and see what happens on the last day. All right, now we're going to go back up to the top of the public hearings. I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 378. And Council, when you're ready.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 378 did have a previous public hearing on February the 10th. But there have been amendments since then. This is a measure that requires a state to inform a defendant of their intent to rely on enhancement facts in writing. And it creates an exception if the parties agree otherwise, or if the court finds a good cause to extend the time limits. The time limits are what are the subject of the amendment, or having some refinement as to deadlines for this notification. The Dash 2 amendment is of interest to the proponents. It's my understanding it modifies the deadline in the original bill that's required for notification to the earlier of either 14 days before trial or 14 days before expiration of a plea offer.
All right, thank you. So I have three people that are scheduled to give testimony: Gil Meyer, Chuck French, and Scott Healy. Want all three of you please come forward.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I can tell you that we've been discussing the Dash 2 amendments, but none of us here have seen the Dash 2 amendments, although we understand that they are available to the committee. We have had work groups. I can say to the committee we've been working diligently and hard on this. It's a conundrum for us all. There are 36 different counties, 36 different practices, and within any one county, they can have different practices with respect to different kinds of cases. So we've structured this bill. Thank you. The Dash 2 amendments were designed to give maximal time available to the district attorney to do what they need to do, but also set a time frame so that the defense has adequate notice prior to the time the defense has to elect whether or not they want to accept a plea offer or whether or not they want to proceed to trial. So what the Dash 2s do is they set as a firm date 14 days prior to trial. But if the county is a county that has a plea offer that expires, not all counties do, but if there's a plea offer that's on the table with an expiration date, then it would require the notice of enhancement facts to be given 14 days prior to the time that offer expires. And our point in doing it that way is the district attorneys control the offer, they control the timing of the offer, and so this allows them maximal latitude and at the same time affording the defense what the defense needs. It's important to point out to the committee there is a escape valve here. If shorter time is needed, then the parties can agree to that mutually, or they can proceed and go to the court for good cause shown. So I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
All right, I'm going to have questions as a panel. So, Chuck, do you want to go next, or Scott?
Sure, I'll do that. Chair Pozanski and members of the committee, excuse me. My name is Chuck French. I'm a deputy district attorney in Multnomah County. As way of background, historically, this entire bill revolves around a decision, Blakely versus Washington, which occurred in 2005, I believe, in requiring the state to plead enhancement facts in situations that exists in statutory schemes like we have here in Oregon and in the state of Washington. I was on the initial committee that was sent to Denver by the governor along with Senator Burdick to talk to other agencies, justice agencies, about the initial Blakely bill. This was a discussion that was had, the issue of due process and notification in Denver, and then the bill that emerged from this in Oregon, I believe it was Senate Bill 525, there was a committee formed again by Senator Burdick here, and I was on that committee with members of the defense bar and the Department of Justice here. And this issue was discussed at some length, and the idea that came out of that was that the term reasonable time would be defined by judges because we were having exactly the same discussion then that we're having now. Essentially, I've just had a chance to look at the Dash 2 amendments. It changes the bill in a way that at least we're partially fine with, and that is the 14 days prior to trial. The other issue, the 14 days after the expiration, or 14 days extended by, no later than 14 days before the expiration of a plea offer, is one which I simply haven't had an opportunity to process, but my initial reaction is you're going to end up with a fair amount of unintended consequences that probably will not be good for the system. My initial reaction would be that prosecutors would tend to file boilerplate notifications, which include virtually all the possible potential enhancement facts on them beforehand. This is something which is common in the criminal justice system, both on the defense side, for instance, in discovery motions, and in a situation like this in the state. We currently do that on our indictments. We include any enhancement fact that is constitutionally permissible. And in addition to doing that, however, we do file very specific notifications later on down the line. I think it would not work well for the system to have boilerplate notifications filed within, you know, a few days of the case being issued. More specifically, I think you'll end up with a, because I've talked to Ms. Meyer about this, and I'm not sure exactly how this would work. After the after a plea offer is made, what would happen if the plea offer is withdrawn and a new plea offer is subsequently submitted by the state? Does the 14-day period of time after the plea offer begin with the first offer, with the second offer? Does a withdrawal of a plea offer, which happens very frequently and often happens because we find out things that that we're investigating, or while we're investigating it, we find out something about someone's background which would lead us to withdraw the plea offer. Does that cut short or cut off the 14 days? I just simply, looking at the wording in this for the first time, see some significant problems that may end up being far more detrimental to the process of the system. I mean, the initial reaction of many prosecutors might be, okay, I'm not going to extend the plea offer until 14 days before trial, thereby giving us essentially aligning both of those time frames with one another. And that's not something we want to do in the system, is to have plea offers extended only right before trial. We want to resolve these cases as quickly as possible. So in summary, looking at these new amendments, I was prepared to talk a lot about enhancement facts filed 35 days after arraignment. I'm not, or was not, totally prepared to talk about this because this is the first time I've seen it. But my, again, my immediate reaction is we're fine with the 14 days before trial. I think there are going to be substantial consequences that we haven't thought about with the 14 days after the expiration, or 14 days before the expiration of a plea offer.
All right. Prior to you giving comment, let me just say where the chair's at on this. What I've heard from the defense bar is that they feel that their enhancements are given to them after the plea offer has been extended and expires. I don't think that's fair. I think that if we're going to extend a plea offer, they need to know what's on there, and if they don't take the plea offer, then to hit them with enhancements just doesn't seem right. I mean, it's almost like trial by ambush is to not having everything out on the table, letting them make a decision. So what I'm going to do, Scott, once you give us your testimony, I'm going to ask the three of you to sit down and see if you can work this out. I believe from my discussion with the members on this committee, we're ready to move something forward. We want to just make sure everyone has an opportunity to know what they're facing and know what the options are before they make these decisions, because it almost makes it seem like if they don't take this offer, we're going to double up on them or whatever. And that's not the perception I think we want on our side.
Scott. Good morning. Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. I, of course, echo what Mr. French talks about. I just want to talk a little bit about the practical realities then. I know Senator Przanski.
Scott, can you just put your name on the record?
I apologize. Thank you. My name is Scott Healy, and I'm a deputy DA in Clackamas County, also here representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I apologize. I'll get that right one of these days. Anyway, and Senator Przanski, I know that you're either currently a prosecutor or have been a prosecutor in the past, so you know you're familiar with these issues that we're talking about. But I just want to talk a little bit about the practical realities. Some of the most serious offenders that we prosecute, it takes us a long time maybe to track down, you know, their criminal history or the aggravating facts that we might want to file as enhancements. And we already have a number of, you know, statutory timelines that we need to reach, especially if somebody's in custody. We have to try the case within 60 days of arraignment if, in fact, they aren't going to waive that. Oftentimes they do, but sometimes they don't. So if we're backing up to file these enhancement factors 14 days before trial, then that really gives us 46 days, if I'm doing my math right, from the time that the investigation's done, the person's arraigned, and you know our investigators are still out there maybe looking for some of these enhancement facts or aggravating factors. And sometimes the offense, especially if it's a serious offense, it's just occurred, like a serious rape case or child sex abuse case, because, of course, that person's probably been arrested if they're a significant threat to the community or a public safety threat. So we only have, it used to be 5 judicial days to get the grand jury if they're in custody. Arguably, it's just 5 days. And so everything's sped up, as it should be, you know, when someone's in custody and you know, we're concerned about protecting their rights. However, ironically, I guess in a way, the most serious offenders maybe benefit the most because, you know, we of course have limited resources with shrinking budgets and things like that, and the officers are running around trying to find these aggravating factors. We're looking for them as well. To give you an example, I not too long ago had an individual who had criminal histories from seven different states, in New York, Louisiana, Mississippi, Texas, California, Washington, and Oregon. And so we're calling all of these counties, and some of these criminal histories can be from a long, you know, time ago. So, you know, you're calling up a small, obscure county in maybe Louisiana trying to get certified copies of the conviction. Of course, you know, you don't know what their archive situation is. You're trying to find, you know, the police reports because you want to give as much detail. Of course, the defense wants notice with regard to detail as well about exactly what, you know, facts you're relying on with regard to proving these enhancement factors later on if, in fact, you're successful at trial. Then we go to the sentencing phase and you have to prove that. Plus, we also have discovery issues where we, you know, we need to give the defense, of course, notice with regard to all this discovery. So I just want to, you know, I know, Senator Przanski, that you understand a lot of the issues that I'm talking about, but maybe some of the other members of the committee don't know exactly what we do on a daily basis. At the same time, Senator Przanski, I share your concerns. I think that it should be fair. I think that in most counties, although I haven't, you know, gotten on the phone and called every county, but I think in most counties, this is currently, as it's set up, it's working well, where, you know, it's a reasonable period of time, as Mr. French pointed out, the judges are, you know, making the decision about what's a reasonable period of time. As you know, and maybe members of the committee know, we oftentimes have these arguments over discovery. Were we provided discovery in a reasonable period of time? That's really what we're talking about. You know, discovery, notice about what we're up against. There's also the argument, and I've heard some judges in my county make this argument, where they say, well, look, you know, defense counsel or defendant, the person who knows the most about their history is sitting right beside you, and you can have private conversations with them. This isn't something new either. I mean, we've all known about enhancement factors since, you know, November 1st, 1989, when the sentencing guidelines came into effect. Most of the regular or normal enhancement factors, and it's not an exhaustive list, are on the back of the sentencing guidelines grid. And so, Senator Perzanski, you know, to kind of talk about your concern, we give a plea offer, say in Clackamas County, and we normally put a deadline on that plea offer the Friday, 5 o'clock the Friday before, say, the week before trial. If we're required to file the enhancement factors 14 days in advance of that trial, that would be fine. They'd have about 10 days to look at the enhancement factors and look at the discovery that we've provided that supports those, if we even have it yet, because we're, of course, struggling to get that information. Of course, for good cause shown needs to be a part of the statute as well. But just like judges always make decisions about, you know, whether or not it was reasonable or not, and whether or not they're going to allow something to occur or not, that's going on in our county every single day, and the judges are holding our feet to the fire, and I think they are in most counties in the state. I understand there are a couple of counties where, you know, that's not the case, and I just get a little bit nervous when we're going to be legislating something because maybe, you know, it's not working in one or two counties. You know, perhaps, you know, there can be some negotiation that goes on there with regard to, you know, the practical realities of what we're talking about.
Okay, I need you to...
All right, so thank you, and I'm done. I was just finished, but thank you, Senator Perzanski, members of the committee.
All right, thank you very much. Are there any questions that are going to be working to see if we can get anything different? Thank you all very much for coming forward. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 378? Not seeing anyone, I close the public hearing on 378. Now we're going to open up our next public hearing, which is on Senate Bill 496. Council, when you're ready.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 496 authorizes sentencing court to enter order staying sentence or a portion of a sentence imposed in a criminal case that's pending resolution on appeal. There is pending amendment, is my understanding on this.
All right, I have four individuals now that have signed up. What I'm going to do is ask Jess Martin and Sean Wiley to come up first.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I could just make a very brief comment about this bill.
This
issue came to my attention because of someone I know in from Washington County who went through a trial in Marion County and is now incarcerated in Coffee Creek. And when I was talking with some people in the criminal justice area, this issue was identified as something that needed to be clarified. I believe that the stakeholders have been talking, and what they've come up with is different from what is in the original bill, but that's how it came to my attention. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, well, thank you very much. I understand there is an amendment pending, but gentlemen, if you want to put your name on the record, give us the testimony you can. I'll call up the other two, and we'll figure out where we go from there.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jesse Barton. I'm an attorney in private practice here at Salem. This issue regarding stays of sentences and releases on conditions pending appeals, an issue I've actually been dealing with intermittently for the last almost 21 years in this state. As Senator Bonamici just pointed out, is that the statutory scheme that we have right now is unclear. The case law is clear. I've just provided a written testimony on this particular bill, and there's a footnote on the bottom of page 1 which provide some legal authority for why trial courts do have the authority to allow these stays of sentence, releases pending appeal now. But the statutory scheme as it's presently drafted is rather unclear. Some trial courts have problems with the idea that they have this authority to stay sentences pending appeal, and this bill would clarify what that authority is, and also it would provide some guidance through a series of factors that are set out in the bill. I think there's about 8 different factors, a non-exclusive list of 8 factors, 7 or 8 factors that trial courts are to consider in deciding whether to stay a sentence and release the defendant pending appeal. But one point I want to make really clear, and that's that when a trial court issues an order staying a sentence, authorizing a release from incarceration pending appeal, it does not necessarily mean the defendant gets released, because the trial court can impose conditions on that release, conditions that typically will mirror the conditions of pretrial release that the defendant would have had. So, just for example, I have a client right now, his convictions were reversed 2 weeks ago. He could possibly get a stay, an order staying his sentence and a release pending the remainder of his appeal now, except that in order to get that, well, pretrial he had to post a $10,000 bond. He doesn't have that money right now. He's trying to raise it. If he can raise it, he possibly could get released. But if he can't raise that money, it wouldn't even matter if a court issued an order allowing his release pending appeal after posting a $10,000 bond, because he doesn't have a $10,000 bond. So, but you will have, I actually have a copy of the amendments that have been drafted. I don't know if the committee has those. I don't know that those are actually available yet. I was sent a copy of them late yesterday by legislative counsel. But the amendments, as you'll eventually see them, they do address the concerns that are issues or matters that were discussed in an ad hoc work group that was formed. That work group is comprised of folks from the Criminal Defense Bar, Office of Public Defense Services, Department of Justice, and the Judicial Department. One of the things that the amendments will do is state that if a defendant wants to get released pending appeal, he needs to file his motion up to the time, he has until the time that he files his appeal to request that stay of sentence and release pending appeal, except for good cause shown. The bill doesn't define good cause, but in my written materials I explain three circumstances which could serve as good cause. And so that's the idea, is that to use legislative history to establish what good cause possibly could be. The other thing that the bill does is that the original bill has a language in it which states that if a defendant is in prison, while his appeal is underway, and if he wins his appeal, he then is entitled as a matter of right to a stay of sentence and release pending appeal, assuming he can meet the conditions that trial court imposes. That mandatory language has been removed. It will be removed from the Dash 1 amendments. Instead, there'll be language inserted into the bill that says if a defendant wins his appeal, and as a result of his win on appeal, he should be released under the terms of the victory that he's now gained on appeal, then the trial court should take that into account and could use that in deciding whether or not to release the defendant pending appeal. So it still would be permissive. Even a win pending appeal doesn't necessarily mean the defendant's going to get an order allowing his release, but it's going to be something very highly persuasive, I think, in the trial court's consideration of whether a trial court's going to allow an or is going to grant an order or issue an order allowing a stay of sentence and release pending appeal. I know that one reason we wanted to remove the mandatory language was that the Department of Justice folks on our work group had concerns with situations where a defendant might win his appeal in the Court of Appeals, and then subsequently the state would then appeal to the Supreme Court, who would reverse the Court of Appeals decision and then thereby reinstate the defendant's conviction. So the state would be concerned with the person getting released pending appeal after winning in the Court of Appeals, only to see that reversal, that win in the Court of Appeals, be snatched away by a subsequent Supreme Court decision, which then would require the defendant to return to prison. So why let him be released at all if he's just going to have his Court of Appeals victory be reversed by the Supreme Court? Over the weekend, I actually looked at Court of Appeals and Supreme Court decisions from the last year, from the year ending March 31st, 2011. During that period of time, the Court of Appeals, I counted, issued 75 decisions reversing convictions. And then the Supreme Court reversed Court of Appeals reversals. So there were these reversals of reversals in only four cases. So the state's concern, or the DOJ's concern with these reversals, Supreme Court reversals of Court of Appeals reversals, it only happens about 5% of the time. So the real point here is that if a defendant wins his case in the Court of Appeals, the odds are about 95% that Court of Appeals decision is going to hold up, according to the data that I looked at during that 1 year period ending just the end of last month.
All right. Jeff, I'm going to need you to wrap up.
That was it, Mr. Chairman. I thank you for your time.
All right. Sean, what else would you like to add?
Well, Chair Przonski, distinguished members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sean Wiley. I'm a Chief Deputy Defender at the Appellate Division of the Office of Public Defense Services, and my office strongly supports the bill as amended. I just want to add a couple of points to Jesse's testimony, one of which is to realize that this is a matter of trial court discretion. So in other words, the trial court is going to get one of these motions, whatever the circumstance, whether it's right after the conviction or after a successful appeal in the Court of Appeals, say win in the Court of Appeals, and the court will be in a position to evaluate the situation as it exists right then. So a lot of the concerns of the Department of Justice with subsequent possible reversals, the trial court can take that into account. I'm sure that the parties involved would bring all these circumstances to the court's attention, and the court, much like it does in a pretrial release decision, will take all these factors into account and make a decision. What the bill does is it brings much-needed clarity to the law. The statute that exists right now, quite frankly, is a mess. It kind of features antiquated language. There's an odd provision that allows for the defendant to forego his sentence but still end up serving it without getting credit for time. And so there's a lot of confusion that the statute creates. It's also not clear which court to file the motion in. So this bill does a lot to clarify that. It provides guidance to the court. And it also envisions a situation that Jesse was testifying to, Mr. Barton, was there are situations in which there is a clear win on appeal. In other words, the Supreme Court, especially, that we see a number of cases where the Supreme Court comes out with a significant opinion that's going to affect a lot of cases. And as a result, there's a ton of cases that are kind of in line behind that case and awaiting disposition. So if it's clear that the defendant is going to win under that case and the result is going to be a reversal of convictions or sentence or an outright dismissal of the case, it's unfair for the defendant to then be serving time at a time when he should be released to have the kind of long march of the appellate process play out. It also, I might note, costs the state money to house that defendant in the meantime. So this is, in effect, a cost-saving measure.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for the two witnesses? Thank you all very much for coming forward. I actually have three individuals that are going to come up in the next panel. Jennifer Lloyd, Shannon Savelle, and Bill French.
Yes. Good morning, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. Shannon Savelle, Legislative Director of the Oregon Department of Justice. In the interest of time, Jennifer is just going to be in the back if you had any specific questions. Very briefly, we did sit down with OCDLA, the Public Defender Services, Tim Sylvester of our appellate division, and we discussed 496. The primary concern we had was one that has been noted. Section 1, sub 5A. No, sorry, it's a 5B. It's the piece in which the trial court shall, on motion of defendant, release defendant on reasonable conditions. We pointed that out. We believe it should say, at minimum, may. We had some other concerns that sound like they may be addressed in the amendment. However, I don't have the official amendment draft. So, as originally drafted, DOJ would oppose the bill. However, we are waiting to see what the -1 amendments would say.
All right. We're now getting those handed out to us, so they're just coming off the press, as you would say. So hopefully y'all will look at them, get back together as that group. Let's figure out where we're going, what our next step is. Bill? Chuck.
Yeah, it's Chuck French, Chair Przonski, members of the committee. Chuck French, again, from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. Likewise, we looked at this bill and took a look at the wording of the reversal, a reversal of the Court of Appeals requiring someone to be released, and had some significant concerns with that. I guess I needed a chance to look at the new amendments to determine how that's addressed and see where we stand on that.
Okay, great. Thank you. Before you leave, any questions for either of these witnesses? Thank you all very much. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 496. And at this point, get my little sheet. We are now going to open up our next public hearing, which is going to be on 874. Council?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 874. Is a replacement amendment, the -2 amendment. It clarifies that mere possession of marijuana in a public place by a person who is otherwise authorized to possess it legally does not constitute use. Declares an emergency effective on passage.
All right. For those who are scheduled to give testimony, I hope you just heard this bill is going to be used as a vehicle to take care of a legal issue that has come to my attention. Basically, where someone has received a medical marijuana card, They have the authority to actually possess medical marijuana. The question that's before us is clerk giving clarification that they would have the authority under the card to actually possess it within a public area but not consume it in a public area. This is for clarification based on some law enforcement actions and courts wanting some clarity. So with that, we'll take testimony regarding that portion. I've got four people that are signed up. I will break those into two panels. So let's have first Laird Funk and Sarah Duff.
Chairman Prozanski, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, I wish to thank the effort that's gone into making this bill a useful bill. Were I to testify on the previous language, I'd be here for some time because there's a lot of bad in the previous language. Very simply put, I wholly support the new language, and so I won't have much more to say than that.
Yeah, Laird, I need you to put your name on the record,
please. I'm sorry. Laird Funk, Williams, Oregon. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Sarah.
Senator Prozanski and members of the committee, my name is Sarah Duff. I'm the Human Resources Director for Oregon Green Free and a board member for the Institute for Cannabis Therapeutics. I'm here to support this bill. And again, I'm going to echo what Laird said, that I'm very thankful that you did take out the previous language. Any clause that is going to bring us closer to the clause in the Medical Marijuana Act that says that marijuana should be treated like other medicines, I'm going to support anything that supports that clause. So in this case, patients should be able to bring their medicine in public, and they shouldn't be criminalized if non-cardholders see their medicine. So I'd say the next step in the right direction would be to decriminalize medical use in public view, but I appreciate this refreshing bill, which I will support, as opposed to the 32 bills that I will oppose that would further criminalize nonviolent cannabis consumers. Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a short recess, so we'll be on for a moment.
persons.
All right, we're back on the record. Here's where we're at. Senator Telfler has been able to make an appearance at this point, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and open up for the purpose of taking her testimony on Senate Bill 783. So I'm opening up a work session on 783, and counsel, just give us a reminder where we're at, and we'll come back to the other one.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 783 was previously heard on the 7th. It has a couple of amendments pending. The dash 2s were that Senator Telfer spoke to those at the last hearing, and the dash 3s were Representative Schaffler's. This is the bill that the dash 2 amendments replace the original measure and make an exception to allow smoking in smoke shops.
All right, Senator.
Thank you, Chair Prozonsky, and members of the committee, for allowing me to. How did you call it? Appear?
Appear. Cut in.
Sounds very judicial, doesn't it?
I was trying to think of a word, and I said, "Well, we had called your name earlier, but we knew that you were already busy somewhere else."
So had to appear somewhere else.
Yeah, had to appear somewhere else. So now you're appearing here.
Well, thank you very much. I think we have a total fix now to this. It'll be a dash 4, which will encompass everything that we're going to do. And I think I passed out a kind of a little spreadsheet that was provided to me by Dr. Cohn. This is what he printed this out. So in essence, what we're doing is, if you look at the smoke shop column under ventilation, we're moving the same standard in the cigar bar also under the smoke shop, same clean air, Indoor Clean Air Act standard. At the same time, we are removing the assistant fire marshal certification process, which is cumbersome to them since they don't have such a process. But what we have come up with is a fix, because right now the Oregon Health Authority has actually taken over the assistant fire marshal's certification process, and that really isn't a certification process either. So what we've done is discovered in talking to the Department of Consumer and Business Services, Building Codes Division in specific, that the current language in ORS 476.060, which imposes a requirement to, quote, certify that a ventilation system is adequate to prevent smoke from entering any other establishment, end of quote, is not an enforceable standard. The Oregon Mechanical Specialty Code contains standards for proximity of exhaust terminations to air intakes that are designed to avoid intake of exhaust. The proposed language that you will see in dash 4 will provide a standard and allows enforcement by the local building department. Currently, the standards in the mechanical code are used for construction of new smoking lounges. So that in the dash 4, which will encompass the dash 2, but we'll also change the ventilation to read, has a ventilation system that exhausts smoke from the business that is designed and terminated in accordance with the state building code in accordance with the occupancy classification in use. I've checked with the state fire marshal. They like this. I've also discovered that this pulls the Oregon Health Authority out of the necessity to have to spend man hours and time doing this. So there should be no fiscal, because it's actually relieving them of a process that they're currently doing. So with that, I'll answer any questions. But again, hopefully the dash 4 will be before you soon.
Hopefully it will appear here on Monday.
It will appear here, yes, hopefully.
I do have a question.
Right. Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and nice to see you, Senator Telfer, for your appearance. I do have a question. I was looking at my notes from the original testimony when Dr. Cohn testified, and I had documented that he said he was concerned that the bill, even with the amendments, would weaken the Indoor Clean Air Act. So I just heard you say that you thought that the health authority was okay with the dash 4s. Do you know if they are still concerned with the bill in general, or does this allay their concerns?
Chair Prozonsky and
Senator Dingfelder. I have not checked. I met with Dr. Cohn yesterday, could have been the day before, and their concern was more the process and having to spend time in certifying. As far as the ventilation, current law with cigar bars meets the Indoor Clean Air Act. And so we're not asking for any different standard to be applied for cigar shops. We're just asking for that same standard that apparently adheres to the Indoor Clean Air Act that is currently in statute.
And I will follow up with it anyway. We're not moving this today, obviously.
No, we're not.
We
have no amendment. Nothing's
appearing
to
here.
Be able to be moved.
Great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to point out something in the in Dr. Cohen's written testimony. He's quoting the American Society of Heating, Refrigeration, and Air Conditioning Engineers. At present, the only means of effectively eliminating health risk associated with indoor exposure to environmental tobacco smoke is to ban smoking activity. And no other engineering approaches, and it goes on. But in the actual document that we pulled up, that is one bullet point. However, the next bullet point says, although complete separation and isolation of smoking rooms can control ETS exposure in non-smoking spaces in the same building, adverse health effects for the occupants of the smoking room cannot be controlled by ventilation. So the written testimony here would at best not be complete.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Chair Pozanski, if I may address Senator Witsit's comment. I did speak to the doctor on that, and knowing that the report contradicts his testimony, he said, he kind of apologized for that and that he was going to reread the report to make sure, you know, where he testified on that. So I'm sure he's happy to come back and testify when we come forward with the Dash 4. The Building Codes Division of the DCBS is willing to come in and testify with the Dash 4. And the Fire Marshal, who was here earlier, the Fire Marshal's Department, is willing to come back and testify in support of this language, too. So,
all right. Thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and close the work session we have open, which is on Senate Bill 783. And we're going to reopen the hearing that we were in, which is the Senate Bill 874. And I have three individuals to come up, Robert Wolf, Todd Delato, and Lee Berger.
Senator Pozanski and members of the committee, Chair Pozanski, thanks for having me here today. I always enjoy participating in the process. I represent the Oregon, Bob Wolf.
Thank you.
From Portland. I represent the Oregon Marijuana Policy Initiative. We're a group of 12, sometimes 14, of the most active medical marijuana patient and advocacy and support groups in Oregon, and we've come together in the broadest show of unity and cooperation since the original Medical Marijuana Program Act was passed 13 years ago. My member constituents strongly support this amendment to Senate Bill 874 as a excellent common sense and clarifying amendment. I have a couple of suggestions for other minor clarifying amendments I'd like to present to you briefly right now.
You can give those to the chair or to council. We'll look at them. We do not have time to take that type of testimony at this point. But if you'd like to submit that in writing, we will look at it. Realize we have a very short window of opportunity. There may be another opportunity that you could bring those up on the House side if this bill moves forward through the process on the Senate side. Or there may be another bill that's coming from the House over the Senate that we can look at those as well. The intent of the chair is to make sure this clarification takes place, because we've had law enforcement and the courts wanting it to be clarified so we have uniformity within the state. Todd.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski and members of the committee. I'm Todd Delato. I represent the Cannabis Research Committee, and I fully support this amendment to for 874. I think it's a very common sense initiative. Because if without this clarified, if it's interpreted that that possession equals use, then it would pretty much be impossible for patients to leave the privacy of their home with their medicine. It would be impossible for patients to even pick up their medicine at their caregiver's house because there's no doubt they would have to pass through public areas. So, yeah, it's a very good common sense. I assumed this was going to be accomplished by deleting the word possession from the definition of use. That's the most simplest way I have found to fix it. And then I just earlier I read these proposed amendments, which looks like it would accomplish the same thing as well. I just ask that you maybe take a look at just amending the definition by deleting possession. One other thing I want to point out with this is smoking and inhaling, you know, what a lot of people assume identify as marijuana use, and probably what people don't generally want to see in public view, is not the only method for using cannabis. Patients use a sublingual spray like the one developed by GW Pharmaceuticals that's available in Canada. That's, you just spray it under your mouth like a breath spray. There are capsules, there are medicated food products, lotions and salves for topical use. I just wanted to consider these types of uses because often patients who cannot smoke or inhale when they're in a public place often take capsules or edible food products so as not to offend anyone in the public or violate the law. So just like you to consider those non-smoking type uses.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lee?
Chair Przonski, my name is Leland Berger. I'm a lawyer. I live and work in Senator Shields and Representative Frederick's district. I practice statewide representing medical marijuana patients and their providers. I echo the comments both of Mr. Wolf and of Mr. Delato. I will provide the committee with additional suggested changes, and I am concerned, however, that the Dash 2 amendments don't accomplish what the chair intends to accomplish. For the reasons that Mr. Delato says, the medical use of marijuana has a technical legal definition. It's in 475302 sub 8. It means the production, possession, delivery, or administration of marijuana or paraphernalia used to administer marijuana as necessary for the exclusive benefit of a person to mitigate the symptoms or effects of the person's debilitating medical condition. So if a person in public view, for example, were applying a salve or even just possessing marijuana. And you know, it seems like we've gone through this before. We tried to fix this, I remember, in a previous session about the public view or public area. And I know that this particular amendment has to do more with the situation in the Springfield Municipal Court. But as to, at line 16, engages in the medical use of marijuana in public view, the problem is that it would a cardholder would lose their protection by possessing in public view. So if I were, I'm not a patient, although I am now a caregiver, but if I were, and I'm not in possession of medical cannabis now, but if I were, under this amendment, I would lose the protection walking from my car to the committee room, as I read this amendment. Do you follow what we're saying?
I hear what you're saying.
And I agree with Mr. Delato that the easier way to do it is to amend sub 8 of 302 to delete possession. I haven't looked, you know, this is the first time I've seen the amendment. I haven't considered whether, and it's the first time I've heard actually Mr. Delato, or maybe not, but hearing Mr. Delato's suggestion, I'm not sure that there might be some bad collateral consequence from deleting possession in medical use, and I'd ask for an opportunity to look into that and report back to the chair and the committee on it. But again, as drafted, this would prohibit possession. A patient would lose the protection of the law. A patient, a caregiver, or a grower would lose the protection of the law if they possessed in public view.
All right, we can have a little more discussion on this. The intent has been put on the record as to what we're attempting to do. My first reading of this appears to accomplish that. I understand that if you're talking about if someone had some type of a salve or patch that was could be viewed in public, that may be an issue.
No, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm saying possession. If I had it concealed in my pocket, that would be the engaging in the medical use of marijuana. And if I'm carrying it in my pocket in public view, I would lose the protection as you drafted it, even though I understand that's not the legislature's intent here.
All right, so you can work with counsel on this, and we'll see if we can get better clarification.
I should contact counsel directly then.
You can talk to Cheyenne or counsel here, and we will work through it that way.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
This is counsel.
So it's a pleasure and a privilege to appear before this committee. Thank you so much,
you.
Sheriff Brzezinski.
No, thank you.
Thank you. I don't know.
Would law enforcement be aware of this?
I had received a request from law enforcement to give clarification because, as Mr. Berger said, there was a case at Keeneland Springfield, and they thought by their interpretation it needed to be clarified. And that's why the amendment is here. So it was requested from advocates as well as law enforcement for clarification to make certain that everyone knew what the rule was and that it was being enforced properly statewide. Any other questions or comments? Thank you, gentlemen, for coming forward. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 874. And we're now going to open up our public hearing on 926.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, that was the one that were carried over. That's right. Sorry. That one
previously
was over,
the parties were
carried over. All right. So that one, again, is being carried over until Monday, the 18th. So this brings us to our last scheduled public hearing. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 934.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 934 is also pending an amendment that replaces the measure, so I didn't bother to summarize the original content.
All right. So I have a number of individuals who have signed up for 934. I will start with Kevin Sterick, Doug Raff, I believe, Roth, and then Rod Harder.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rod Harder with the National Rifle Association. I'm here this morning to support Senate Bill 934. My testimony will be very brief. We've had numerous complaints recently from our members about the length of time it's taking for background checks to be completed. We've had complaints from dealers who are losing business because of the slowness of the system. I am concerned over the cost increases that are being proposed by the state police in Senate Bill 5538, increasing firearms background checks from a current $10 to $26 is a significant increase. We went to the hearings on these bills. There was no support, not on the bill, excuse me, on the fee increase. There was no support from the public that I could ascertain and the ones I have went to for an increase of that nature. You'll hear from Oregon Hunters Association about the direct impact it will have on them. I'll conclude my testimony with that and let some others go forward.
All right, thank you, Kevin.
Members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Starrett, Oregon Firearms Federation. To be honest with you, Senator, Chairman Brzezinski, I'm not really sure what your intention is for this bill now, so I'm just going to give you my testimony on the original language of the bill. You already have all the exhibits, so I won't repeat any of that. And delays and the long waits on the phone have already been addressed. But there's another thing that I think the committee needs to know about, and that is that there have been instances of this very sensitive information that's collected by the state police when these background checks are being done of being abused by them. And they now have a policy they have a stated policy of destroying this information very quickly when the statute allows them to have 5 years. But in the past, they have given this information out, and as a result, people who have committed no crime have been dragged out of their house at 4 o'clock in the morning and sent to mental institutions where they were quickly declared perfectly fine and then returned to their homes. But it was the release of the data that was collected by OSP that allowed these abuses to take place. Furthermore, in the past, the state police had a stated policy of telling dealers, it was in their documents, which you have, of telling dealers that they could not do a transfer without an approval code, which is not the case. You can after 3 days. They've corrected that in their most recent publications, but it's still the policy of the state police not to inform dealers that they have that right to do that. When NICS does background checks, they inform the dealers of when the transfer can take place in the absence of an approval. So in addition to the obvious cost factors and the delays that we're dealing with and the potentially great increase in the cost factor, we're concerned about what's done with the data, which in fact NICS does not collect.
Doug. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Doug Raff. I own and operate Gun Crafters here in Salem. I've been in the firearm business now since 82 here in Salem. So I've been on the front lines with every kind of system they've come through. And, you know, I have to say that the system does work. It has worked in the past, so I don't fault that. But in the last 6 months, we've seen a complete change in the system. I mean, I'm on the front lines. I'm selling the firearm. I'm filling out the paperwork. And I'm calling in these checks day to day. And we've had, you know, an example, Black Friday is a big sale day, you know, for every store, every retailer. We were getting busy signals. We couldn't sell a firearm. You know, we'd call up and get a busy signal. And we'd have to just sit there and redial and redial and redial. And we couldn't sell a gun. And, you know, at other times we've had, you know, Fridays, or if there's a gun show on a weekend, whether they're understaffed or what's happening or the system just overloaded, we don't know. But we're getting busy signals. I can have five people lined up waiting, wanting to buy a gun. I've done my job trying to sell it, and I can't transfer it. And I tell them, come back on Monday. Maybe the system will be cleared up then. So a lot of people don't want to do that. They'll walk out, and I lose the sale, and we lose the revenue. You know, there's a lot of this going on, and that's why I'm in favor of Representative Thatcher and putting the system back to the feds where we don't have this tie-up. You know, we don't have a fee, period. The $10 fee would be gone. To increase the fee, I don't know if that's going to help the system. So if you have any questions, you know, I'm doing it every day here, and I'm experiencing it. So,
all right, thank you. Questions? All right, Kevin, you gave some testimony which is concerns to what I've heard regarding release of this information inappropriately.
Yes.
If you can get some of that and bring that to the chair.
You should have it in the date. It was all delivered to you guys electronically yesterday.
And if we have any questions, I can follow up with
you. Please do.
Mr. Chair, I was just looking for the information, Kevin. I don't see it. You said it was in a magazine article?
Well, there is a magazine article that talks about it, but it was a case out of Medford where a employee of ODOT made some purchases. That information of those purchases was given to local police. That guy's house was surrounded by three SWAT teams, and he was taken into custody in a mental health hold. The police then went into his home, confiscated his guns without a warrant. He was released from the hospital almost immediately and then came to us to help him get his firearms back. But my understanding is, the Oregon State Police have changed their policy now about releasing information without a subpoena. But my understanding is that even prior to that change, their rules were that it would not be released without an ongoing criminal investigation, which there wasn't. And as a result of this and the exposure and the attention from the press that this guy got, he's been here, he's testified in front of you, he's now lost his job, his home has been foreclosed on, he is completely destitute and has had to move back to Florida to live with family.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, caveat with my testimony, when I'm testifying on the bill in front of me and not on any subsequent bill.
All right. It looks like I got Elkins and Wiley. Is that like two different people? Please come forward. And how are you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Hunters Association. With me today is Dave Wiley, also representing the Oregon Hunters Association. We want to talk about the language that's in the current bill. I don't know what the amendments are, and our issue is what's in the current bill. So that's what we're going to talk about. We are the largest, we believe, nonprofit conservation association in Oregon. And through our 25 chapters around the state, we are able to put about $250,000 of our own money into wildlife and habitat projects each year. And we do this through fundraisers through our annual banquets. And currently we estimate that the Oregon Hunters Association in its banquet guests spend close to $5,000 annually on background checks. And with the proposed background check fee increase to $30, that would triple us to about $15,000 or more. As you've heard, that the current rate is around $10. Multiply this figure times the number of other groups holding a similar number of banquets: Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, Ducks Unlimited, Northwest Turkey Wild Turkey Federation, Mule Deer Foundation, NRA, and others. You have easily a six-digit sum from our nonprofit sportsmen's groups going to pay OSP for doing background checks. And we believe this is a waste of conservation dollars. We would like to be able to do this, provide this service without the fee, and that is why we support the bill. We believe in background checks, Mr. Chair. We just don't like spending the money to do that.
Okay.
Thank you. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
All right, let me get Mr. Wiley's testimony, and then we'll see if there are any questions.
I'm here as a mouthpiece for technical purposes, but I do support the bill.
I do need you to put your name on the record.
Oh, my name is Dave Wiley.
Dave.
I'm a member of the Oregon Hunters Association, and I live in Sublimity, Oregon.
All right. Thank you very much. Questions for either gentleman? Thank you very much for coming forward. The last two signed up is Carla K. Edwards and Penny Acamento. All right, looks like we have one other one too, so come on up.
Good morning, Chair Prozanski. My name is Carla K. Edwards, and I'm actually the owner of a firearms store called Buck Wild Shooter Supply, and I'm here before you today to support this in honor of our customers. They're the ones that pay these fees, and we believe that this is an easy way to actually relieve them of that. It's important to note that we are a small mom and pop shop. Often it's just my husband trying to run the store, and we do find ourselves tied up on the phone trying to wait either on hold or getting a busy signal as we try to get through this process. The unfortunate part is while we have someone on hold that we're trying to actually sell the firearm, if there's another customer in the store, it's quite difficult for us to service more than one customer at a time while we sit on hold. Therefore, we think it really advantageous for us to be able to do it electronically. Our store is set up now that we can fill out our 4473, which is the background check information that is needed, which is provided by NICS in the first place. So we think that this is just simply a streamlining bill that actually serves purposes both for us as a store and providing customer service, because that's what we do. You can buy a firearm on the internet much cheaper. It's our customer service that drives customers to us so that we can answer questions about firearms that they can't get answered on the internet. That is our advantage. So when we are tied up on a phone line and not able to address customer concerns or answers, that really takes away our business advantage from internet providers. So we believe that this is an important issue, and anything that can be more cost-effective and streamline government is always an important issue.
All right, thank you. So, Penny?
I'm Elise Gauthier. This is Penny Okamoto. We're both with Ceasefire Oregon, and I'll hand you this test. Ceasefire Oregon opposes Senate.
I need names on the record.
ELISEGAUTIER. Penny OKAMOTO. We oppose this bill because it would allow greater numbers of prohibited purchasers to buy firearms. The reason everyone is waiting on the background check is because the Oregon State Police is doing the research necessary to make sure that the person who wants to buy the gun has not been committed to a mental institution, is not a convicted felon, or is not a dangerous, violent person. Sometimes that research takes a while. The state should not be in the business of speeding up gun sales, because the risk is that dangerous, violent people will be getting guns and shooting them in Oregon. The impact of the Senate Bill 934 was quantified with remarkable precision a few years ago in a study funded by the U.S. Department of Justice. I will send you my written testimony in electronic form so you can click on the links and see this for yourself. But this is the study made in 2003, and it compared states that use their state law enforcement to run the background checks versus states that go directly to NICS. The conclusion was that the use of the Oregon State Police as the point of contact resulted in a 22% increase in the number of clearance denials. That is, 22% more people were correctly identified as ineligible for firearms purchasers when the Oregon State Police served as the contact than when the inquiry went directly to NICS. That's conclusively shown in this report. Also, it's not just a streamlining process. There are requirements in Oregon law that are not replicated in the federal law. For example, you can't sell a gun to a person in Oregon if the person has been convicted of a violent misdemeanor in the past 4 years. Those people can buy guns under federal law. I don't think the NICS check is going to catch those people here in Oregon. Not only that, but thousands of mental health records and criminal background records have not yet made it to the NICS system. The Oregon State Police accesses a number of databases that are not accessed in the NICS system. And the U.S. Department of Justice has testified to that fact, and you'll see that down at the bottom of the first page of my testimony. State databases may also be checked for disqualifying information. These state databases include the state's own criminal history records, which generally have more complete information on arrest dispositions, including information on whether charges were dismissed or the person was convicted of some other charge. They may also check state records that have not been provided to the FBI on individuals who have disqualifying mental health records or are under a domestic violence restraining order. So if you just go straight to NICS, you're not going to get the 22% of people you would have gotten had you gone through the Oregon State Police, and you're not going to get everyone who would be disqualified under state law. Until the federal NICS system is equal to Oregon's, the Oregon State Police should remain the point of contact. And therefore, we, Ceasefire Oregon, urges you to vote no.
All right. Thank you.
My name is Penny Okamoto. I'm the executive director of Ceasefire Oregon. My colleague Elise Gauthier has very eloquently and thoroughly established why we need to continue to have the Oregon State Police as a point of contact and not the NICS system from the federal database. I also wanted to note, someone had said that there were a lot of long lines on Black Friday. I don't know if any of you have ever been shopping on Black Friday, but where isn't there a long line? Does this mean that we're supposed to go to all the computer systems for all the credit card companies and say, look, you're really slowing down sales here, so we're going to give you a lot of money to boost up your systems? No, of course we're not going to do that. Okay? What we're really taking a look at is making sure that people who are prohibited by law from getting firearms do not get those firearms. And that right there, that reason of prohibiting people from getting firearms who should not, by law, be having firearms, that is more important than how fast we can sell guns. Now, according to a survey in 2007 by the Small Arms Survey Group, that's in Geneva, Switzerland, the United States of America has over 270 million firearms in 2007 and 300 million people. That's one gun for every man, woman, and child in America. One gun for every 9 out of 10 men, women, and child in America. Okay? So we don't have a problem here selling guns in America. We're actually doing a pretty good job. But what we're not doing a good job is making sure that people who are mentally ill don't get firearms, people who have felonies don't get firearms, people who are prohibited by mental illness from getting firearms, people who have committed misdemeanor violence don't get firearms. That's what we're really looking at, the safety of our country and who is getting firearms and making sure that they are legally able to possess weapons and not prohibited. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Questions for any of the witnesses? Thank you all very much, all three, for coming forward.
Thank you.
That's all I had scheduled on 9:34. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on 9:34? Not seeing anyone. We're going to close the public hearing on 9:34. Now, we have reached the point of where we have some bills that are ready to be worked for work session, and we have some that we're still waiting to see if stuff comes in. So I think what we're going to do here is we are, in fact, going to go ahead and start with our ones that we know that are ready to go, and we'll just go to the top of the list. Okay. So I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session at this time on Senate Bill 557-2.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 557 was heard on the 7th. This is the measure that requires district attorneys in each county to organize sex assault response teams. Most of the counties in Oregon already have a team organized. The discussion revolved around consistency and uniformity of training, investigations, and service provision to the victims. The Dash 2 Amendment, in particular, permits adoption of protocols that are specific to child victims that are developed pursuant to ORS 418-7 and modified the requirements to allow for facilities that conduct forensics exams and that treat only child victims of sexual assault to allow for them.
All right. Now, I remember when we had the bill before, we took testimony, we had some questions and wanted to get some clarification regarding whether the amendment was going to cover everything that needed to be covered. Can Council remind us, did we go ahead and adopt the Dash 2s at that time, or do they need to be adopted?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no amendments were adopted. They still need to be adopted.
All right, so we need the Dash 2s. I will point to the two members. We received a letter from Senator Edwards' office that clarifies the issues that we are trying to ensure that we did not need another exemption or statement regarding the, I'm going to call them the... facilities that have conducted these type of investigations and examinations, and based on the letter that's from Senator Edwards' office, it appears that they had received word from Alan Dell, one of the deputy LCs, that the exemption for those organizations such as the Liberty House or that of the Kids First, that they were not necessary because they are not hospitals. And so with that, we'll take a motion on the dash.
Mr. Chair, if I can interrupt.
Yes, you
may. My apologies. And members of the committee, I overheard Senator Cruz. I failed to state on the record there's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on the Dash 2. So I failed to state that.
Okay, because I don't have the document.
They should be. They came in
separate.
You don't
print a hard copy, as I recall, for
at least
when there isn't a statement.
Let's see if I've got one. I don't know if you got them or not. Yeah. No, I don't have those.
I believe right. We don't print them when there's no impact, but we do print them when there's a minimal or an expenditure, if I recall correctly.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can I ask a question about the clarification from Legislative Council? It was my understanding that based on the testimony that places like CARES Northwest wanted to be included in the provision, and they're not a hospital, and it looks like on line 19, it says the paragraph does not apply to a hospital. So I just want to make sure that the clarification does what we thought that they wanted it to do.
Sarah,
why don't you come on up? My understanding is that CARES Northwest was taken care of. It wasn't CARES Northwest per se. They're concerned about the advocacy centers that have the same protocol. Well, I should say the same protocol. They do the same type of examinations, but they don't have the same protocol of being a medical model. So, Sarah, do you want to give some clarification?
Yeah, Chair Prasansky, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Hoyt. I'm the legislative aide to State Senator Chris Edwards. CARES Northwest were specifically exempting from the bill because although they are not a hospital, they function within Legacy Emanuel. So they are part of, sorry, I just ran here from our office because I knew you were going to work session so quickly. They function as part of Legacy Emmanuel. So they are actually in the pediatric emergency room of Emmanuel. So making sure that we understand that they are part of a hospital. They aren't actually in an emergency room themselves, but they function within an emergency room.
Mm-hmm. All right. Any other need for clarification from Sarah? Thank you very much.
Yeah.
So the chair will entertain a motion on the dash two amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendment, Senate Bill 557.
Senator Cruz moves the dash two amendments into Senate Bill 557. Discussion? Objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, just the clarification on the fact that we don't have the paperwork. You said if there is none, we don't get paperwork, or?
That's my understanding. As part of the paperless effort, which we tried to do 100% at the beginning of session, but we've retracted from slowly over the course of the session, if there is no impact, we're not printing the hard copy of the documents, but if there is an impact or a minimal or indeterminate, we are printing a copy, mm-hmm. and the rest of the staff is nodding with us.
All right, so let me just ask to put this on the record. Council, is there any fiscal impact under 557-2?
No, Mr. Chair, and no revenue impact either.
Thank you. All right.
Big picture, I think that's problematic for those of us that are not paperless to not have the documents.
All right. Do you not want to make the motion? Senator Bonamici, would you be so kind to move the bill?
And we've adopted the amendment.
We have.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 557 is amended with a dash two amendment moved forward with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Bonamici moves Senate Bill 557 as amended by the dash twos to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, besides the fact that we don't have the paperwork, and this move to the paperless system has been in many ways a disaster for a lot of folks. There's also the fact that I'm not quite sure, because the testimony was most counties have this. This is happening organically. Why we're putting it in a specific form when it's already happening in an organic fashion, and now we're forcing it from the top down. I'm just not sure that this is the proper approach.
All right, any other discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to support this today. I may on the floor at a later time, but I haven't had an opportunity to talk with the counties that I represent. This just feels like an unfunded mandate. I realize that there is no fiscal, but I want to talk with my DAs and other folks and get an idea of whether they feel the same way.
Fair enough. And regarding to Senator Cruz's statements regarding the process that we're using, I would say take it to the president. With that, any other objections besides Senator Cruz and Senator Wissett?
Mr. Chair, I have objections to the trying to get to the paperless system, but they all no objections.
All right. I appreciate that.
I have no objections. It's working great.
All right. So regarding the bill moving forward, we do have the constitutional requirement. Senator Przanski, Senator Bonamici, Senator Dingfelder voting yes. And at this point, Senator Cruz and Senator Wissett voting no, with the understanding that at least Senator Wissett may want to change his position on the floor. Anything else?
I'd be happy to carry the bill, too.
And we're going to let Senator Edwards carry the bill with a backup of Senator Dingfelder. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 557. Our next work session to open up will be on Senate Bill 815.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 815 was previously heard on March the 31st. There's no amendment on this measure. There is, apologize for the delay, minimal revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact, so there should be printed copies of those available to the members.
Yes,
previously heard, as I said, on 331, there is no subsequent referral. This is the measure that authorizes the owner of a real property to use a transfer on death deed to pass real property outside of probate at the owner's death. There was discussion from the Oregon Law Commission that this measure was the product of a work group. The act was tailored, a model act was tailored to align it with other aspects of Oregon law, and it does come from the Oregon Law Commissioner on the recommendation of the Uniform State Laws, commissioners on the Uniform State Laws.
All right. Chair would entertain a motion on Senate Bill 815.
You don't want a chance to quiz Lane Shetterly all over again? Or? Okay.
He's raising both hands there.
Okay. But if someone wants to, I guess we may have time to quiz him for 30 seconds or 45.
Well, and if that's the option, Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 815 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Well, you know, if you asked a question of an attorney, you're not going to get an answer in 30 to 45 seconds. So with that, we have Senator Cruz moving Senate Bill 815 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Bonamici, would you like to carry this one?
Yes, I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, we'll have Senator Bonamici be the carrier on 8:15, and we'll close the work session on 8:15. We'll open up our work session on Senate Bill 867-2. And counsel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 867 was previously heard on March the 31st. The dash twos, which incorporate the dash ones, there is no revenue impact, no fiscal impact. This is the measure that authorizes the Department of Environmental Quality to make agreements affecting activities on real property as a means to reduce exposure to hazardous substances. They call these measures institutional controls, requires recordation unless agreement specifies other ways, and makes such agreements valid and enforceable with any conveyance or assignment of interest in the property. The dash amendment, which, as I said, incorporates the dash ones, redefines terms throughout. It references the grantor and grantee rather than the parties. It makes other conforming and stylistic changes, permits agreement where it's reasonably related to remediation as determined by the department, and makes one further refinement to insulate these agreements against those who are acquiring interest, subsequent interest in the property. This was a Oregon Law Commission measure, and we heard testimony from them, as well as from Department of Environmental Quality on the previous hearing date.
Okay, so at this point, we would need to adopt the dash twos?
That's correct.
All right, because of, let's say prior somewhat notice, I'm going to ask Senator Bonamici if you'd be so kind to move the dash twos.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we adopt the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 867.
Senator Bonamici moves the dash twos into Senate Bill 867. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 867 is amended but with a dash two amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Bonamici now moves Senate Bill 867 as amended by the dash twos to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
Dean Fuller.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would like to declare a potential conflict of interest on this bill because my husband is an engineer on the Portland Harbor project for the Department of Environmental Quality.
Thank you, Senator.
That covers a lot.
Well, it was eye to eye. All right. So, at this point, objections to the motion that's before us. I have Senator Wissett and Senator Cruz objecting to moving the bill forward as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I will. We have the constitutional necessity of three votes, so it motion passes. And?
Mr. Chair, I would like to serve notice of a possible minority report.
And Senator Cruz serves notice of a possible minority report. Is there anyone else who's going to join him?
Oh, absolutely.
The good senator on my far left is joining us to my near left. With that, we're going to go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 867 with the understanding that we will, let's see, I think the chair will carry this one just because of the conflict of the senator to my far right.
And I would like to thank the chair in the middle right.
All right, so let's see. We are now moving into Senate Bill, work session on Senate Bill 878.
And Chair Prasansky, members of the committee, Senate Bill 878 would carve out an exception to the general requirement that private security personnel be licensed for persons employed for the purpose of controlling access at the entrance of a premises by a licensee of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, provided that these individuals are not armed and are not hired with the primary responsibility of taking law enforcement action. There is one amendment that has been advanced for consideration. This is the Dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 878, which would add an exception or make a modification to existing subsection G, which pertains to individuals who monitor fire alarms. The new language would be a person who monitors alarm systems that are not designed to detect threats to public safety or personal well-being, the practical import expanding this from fire alarm detection to other kinds of chemical monitoring. As amended, Senate Bill 878 is projected to have a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
All right, and it's my understanding the proponent of the bill did not want to move forward the Dash 1s that we had on the table at one point. But we do have a Dash 3 that the Chair would entertain a moment on.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the Dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 878.
All right, Senator Cruz moves the Dash 3s into Senate Bill 878. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 878 as amended by the Dash 3 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 878 as amended by the Dash 3 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to support the bill hesitantly because there were some concerns raised, particularly by the City of Portland, and some safety issues. It's my understanding that this bill is intended to deal with some pretty narrow situations. And since we're going to be back in February, I'm going to ask the proponents and the opponents to keep an eye on how things are working out there and come back if there really is a safety concern. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your work on this bill. I am going to vote no, but for the same reasons that Senator Bonamici raised. However, I think I'll be the one vote of dissension to make sure that there's some discussion about this in February. I do have several problem establishments in my district and do have concerns about lessening any requirements, so that's why I'll be no vote.
All right. All right, so we've had our discussion. Okay, objection to the motion. I have Senator Dingfelder objecting. Anyone else? Motion carries, and we will, let's see. Senator Cruz, would you carry this one on the floor? Senator Cruz would be the carrier on this bill, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 878 with the Dash 3. All right. Now we're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 450-2s.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 450 is Chair's evidentiary measure that creates a statutory privilege between communications between parents and children. The Dash 2 amendment makes the application explicitly prospective, and this was raised at the end of the previous hearing, which was yesterday, by Senator Whitsitt. They are separate amendments. The Dash 1 was adopted yesterday. The Dash 2 makes that one last change.
So we already did the ones.
Yeah, the ones are done. I think now we need to take a motion on the Dash 2s.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 450.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 2 amendments into Senate Bill 450. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to Senate Bill 450 as amended by the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 450 as amended by the Dash 1s and the Dash 2s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. The Chair will carry 450 to the floor. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 450. And
there's no need to recess.
I want my cheat sheet that I just had. I just had a.
I didn't make it.
No, no, there's that, but there was another one. There it is. Okay, so we're at that stage. As we opened this morning at 8, we said that there are a few bills that we were holding back in the sense of waiting to see if they were actually going to be ready to move forward. They are not, based on our last check with the appropriate departments. So we're going to go back over what we have left from today's docket that will be moved into Monday. The committee is moving and carrying over the following bills: Senate Bill 186, Senate Bill 408, Senate Bill 616, Senate Bill 619, Senate Bill 740, Senate Bill 934, Senate Bill 926, Senate Bill, Senate Bill 734, Senate Bill 783. Now, on those, all of those are being carried over for a work session, with the exception of Senate Bill 926 that's being carried over for a public hearing as well as a possible work session. Council, please check my order. Okay, I thought I did, but okay, regarding the ones that were under our public hearings section, we are carrying over for work session Senate Bill 378, Senate Bill 496, Senate Bill 874. And I'm going to go ahead and say works on also 934. And then if I didn't say it, 346 is also being carried over. That is for work session. I believe the only one that's going carried over for a public hearing and possible work session is 926.
That's correct.
All right.
Public hearing and 734, Mr. Chairman.
And 734, I think I've already announced it, but it's being carried over till Monday. All of these are being carried over till Monday, April 18th. And as I said, we already had the five that we've already stated at the very top. All right. Does it sound like I've got everything covered? I've got everyone here. No one's yelling and screaming. All right. So what we're going to do for Monday, we will be back here. Our time to start will be 8:30 on Monday, the 18th. With that, committee members, thank you very much for indulging all the chaos that we had today. And with that, we're closed until Monday morning.